Professor Fine, where identify yourself and we'll make you host and we'll start in 1 minute. Thank you, Dr. Kohler. Vakasha. And okay. Okay. We'll take a 12 second break. Everybody, just you want to catch your friends. And welcome. Professor Fine is making his debut on ThermoMotion. But as I said, we don't have time for any introduction. So, but Professor Fine is the Churgin Professor of Jewish History at Yeshiva University and Director of the YU Center for Israel Studies. And we're looking forward to a share now on the Hanukkah menorah, a curious history of a ritual object. Okay, Bakasha, Professor Fine.
Good morning, Jay. Good morning, everybody. You know, we tend to take our Hanukkah menorahs for granted, but the reality is the Chanukiah, as it was called by Western Svardim, meaning in Amsterdam or in Serbia, and then into modern Hebrew, thanks to the Ben Yehuda family at the turn of the century, is an object that has great resonance across the Jewish experience in ways that we don't always think about. Let me back up on that for a moment. Ashkenazim referred to that lamp as a menorah, which is, of course, one of those words that comes from the word ner, which does not mean candle, but means lamp. Candles didn't get used for lighting for Hanukkah until well into the high Middle Ages. Little oil lamps were. I happen to have one that happens to come from the Hasmonean period, which is pretty standard looking. You can see it was burnt at some point or another. And this particular lamp is simply a piece of clay that was squeezed together to create a surface on the top. Now, we Ashkenazim refer to that lamp as menorah to Chanukah, or the menorah to create a kind of gezerah shavah, to create a relationship between all those lamps that we light in our homes and the great menorah of the Beit HaMikdash. And so there's a connection created where the Sephardi term creates a name for a object that serves for Chanukah. And in modern Hebrew, of course, where there's a lack of nouns, menorah can also be the lamp that's lighting up my room right now, or it can be that thing for Chanukah. And so there were two choices. One was menorah to Chanukah, and the other is Chanukiah. I tend toward the latter, and let me show you some slides and tell you why. Okay? I'm going to share my content screen. And if you don't see it, please tell me. Okay.
You don't see it yet, but I imagine you know
you
that.
Should.
No.
I shared it. Do you have it yet?
Nope.
All right, let's try it again. Mr. Zoom is always very helpful until he's very helpful. It says here, start broadcast. Got it?
Now it's, well, it's
lovely.
History. Yeah. I mean, it's got
lovely.
There we
now,
go.
Now, if you were to go to the Israel Museum and see an amazing wall of Hanukkah menorahs, of menorah to Hanukkah, you would see lamps that are virtually the same straight line with 8 burners, usually in a straight line, with another one off to the side, unless it got lost in the course of history, going back to the high Middle Ages and continuing until yesterday. Now, let's think for a moment what the ideological statement is of creating that wall of Hanukkah menorahs at the Israel Museum. Whether you are in the Yemenite diaspora, whether you are in the Bukharan diaspora, whether you are in the North African diaspora, the Ashkenazi diaspora, even the American diaspora, all the Jews do the same thing in their different ways. And that's the statement that the Cultural Zionist exhibition that was created by a fellow named Mordechai Narkis intended to present. This is Mordechai Narkis, the founding director of what became the Israel Museum. And this is his most important book. It's called Menorah to Chanukah. It was published in the darkest moment in Jewish history, 1939. And it was published in Palestine at the highest possible level a book could be published in Palestine in 1939, which was not particularly high quality, but it was the best they could do at that moment. Now, I have to admit that I read this book in high school. It was the first book I read cover to cover in the Hebrew language. I had a very good and kind Hebrew teacher in high school. And this book is still, to my mind, the most important book on Jewish ritual art in existence. If you'd like to own a copy, you can go to myacademia.edu site and download it. Now, Menorat Chanukah, its strength was that Narkis created a virtual community out of a diaspora of Chanukah menorahs. Everyone different, but everyone the same. And he goes through from the very beginning until the 19th century and provides vast bibliography. And being a yeshiva boy, he knew how to use his Rishonim and Acharonim in order to make this book happen. Today it's old-fashioned on almost every page, which I would hope that they say that about my books in the amount of time that separates us us and his book. In another 80 years, I hope they'll say, his book is old-fashioned, but well worth reading. Let's take a look. What I want to do with you, boom, is go back to the very beginning of that thing that we call a menorah, a Chanukah, or call a Chanukiah, when it didn't exist. Let's go all the way back to Josephus in his book called The Antiquities of the Jews, which was finished in the early 90s of the first century. Josephus tells the story of the Hashmonaim, and he tells it based mainly all the way through on his reading of the apocryphal book known as First Maccabees. He didn't seem to have Second Maccabees, but he quotes First Maccabees, and he tells about the first Chanukah when Yehuda Maccabee went into the Beit HaMikdash in 164 BCE in December, and this is what he said. And so Judah and his fellow citizens celebrated the festival of the restoration. That's really important. The festival of the restoration. That's what it was called in antiquity. That's what it's called in the gospel according to John. The word Chanukah means the dedication of the Chanukah to Mizbeach, as we say. The restoration of the sacrifices for 8 days. And omitted no sort of pleasure. Remember, we are in December. We are in Kaf Hei Kislev of the year 164 BCE, the first day of Hanukkah. But everyone feasted upon very rich and splendid sacrifices, and they honored God and delighted themselves with psalms of praise and playing of harps. Indeed, they were so very glad at the revival of their customs, and after so long a time, having unexpectedly regained their right to worship, they made it a law that for posterity they should keep a festival celebrating the restoration of the temple worship for 8 days, period. Then he goes on with a phrase that doesn't appear anywhere in First Maccabees, his sort of own reflection. Remember, Josephus is sitting in Rome, writing for a Roman audience mainly, maybe some Jews, but mostly Romans, in the 90s, 20-some years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and this is what he says. And from that time to this, we celebrate this festival, which we call Fota, lights. I suppose the reason was because this liberty beyond our hopes was brought to light, wordplay, and so this name was given to the festival. You notice that First Maccabees called it the Festival of the Restoration of the Sacrifices. New Testament called it the Festival of the Restoration of the Sacrifices. Chazal later call it the same. Josephus says that in his world, they refer to this festival as the Festival of Lights. So next time you wish somebody Chag Orim Sameach, realize that you are actually citing Josephus. But what's interesting about this is where he puts his emphasis, and that's where we begin our story of the Chanukah lamp. Now, Josephus explains to us exactly why this rededication happened on Kaf Hei Kislev. He tells us that the temple had been profaned 3 years earlier by Antiochus as a pagan holiday on the 25th of Kislev. So in kind of poetic justice, Jews were lighting their lamps on the 25th of Kislev, 3 years after the temple had been, had rededicated the temple on the 25th of Kislev, 3 years after the temple had been destroyed or profaned by Antiochus. So Jews somehow, because of the Maccabees, now have a winter solstice holiday parallel to the winter solstice holiday that was created, that was imposed, that was placed in Jerusalem by Antiochus 3 years earlier. So voila, we have a festival of lights, as Josephus describes it, which is a winter solstice holiday. Now, the Bavli in Avodah Zarah references this kind of winter solstice connection to Chanukah. And you may know the story. When Adam saw the days getting shorter, Amar, Oili, Shema Bishvil Shesarachti Olam Chashuch Ba'adi, Bechozel Etovohu. Oh my God. Perhaps because I made the world filthy, it's going back to Genesis, Tohu Ovohu. Zohi mitash nit kasa alai mina shamayim. God's going to get me. Amad v'yashav chet yamim b'ta'anit v'tfilah. Well, he rose and he fasted for 8 days and prayed. Now, I'd like to see his sidur, but that's a different question. Kevan shera'at kufat tevet, when tevet started, v'ra'ah shema arich v'holech, and he saw that the days were getting longer, amar, oh, no, I got it wrong. Min hago shel olam hu. This is how the world works. Halach v'asah shmona yamim tovim. He went off and he made 8 days a festival instead of 8 days of fast, right? Me'ever liyom tov, if you wish. L'shana acheret as'an le'elu ve'elu yamim tovim. And then from then on, he made these days festival days. Hu kva'am l'shem shamayim. And he did this, of course, goes the commentator in the Brita. And I kept the censored version because it works for my purpose. And they set these days to worship the stars. When in fact, that's exactly what Antiochus was doing, setting these days to worship the stars. After all, the Roman holiday, which is the festival of festivals in Rome, that was celebrated at the end of the month of December, which is the end of Kislev, is known as Saturnalia, dedicated in honor of Saturn, when all the brace face of Saturn, meaning Jupiter, when all of the rules break down. In other words, people gamble, as you see here. The masters will sit at the same table with their slaves. Revelry, special garments, a real extravaganza in the way that Christian authors later referred to the debauchery of the whole thing. Here we have Josephus sitting in Rome and wanting to explain his festival at the end of this, at the same time as Saturnalia. And he said, oh, we call it lights, which of course is what Christians, or what pagans were doing as well. They were celebrating the festival of Jupiter. The festival of Saturn, the festival of the renewal of the sun. And so everyone's doing it. You can see why Josephus, living in a world full of Romans, would immediately attach his holiday to what's going on around him, probably to parties that he himself is attending. Typical Roman banquet, just for fun, slaves, children, everybody's in revelry. It's a painting from Pompeii, as was the previous. This is a cartoon that came out in the second decade of the 20th century. It was put out in a Zionist newspaper in Germany. And it refers to Hanukkah as Darwinian evolution, with the menorah on the left and the Christmas tree on the right, and the various stages, sort of like Frankenstein's monster going in and out, or Jekyll and Hyde, going into either becoming a Christmas tree or becoming a Hanukkah menorah, dealing with the complexities of Jewish identity exactly at that winter solstice, when Christians are celebrating the winter solstice as well, the continuation of Saturnalia, otherwise known as Christmas, and Jews are celebrating their festival of lights, as Josephus called it, everyone with their lighting, and the question became culturally... Yes?
Yeah.
The question became culturally, how much is your Hanukkah like Christmas and how much is it like the general population? Or alternately for Christians, noticing that Jews are lighting lights, how much are they like us? Now, I put this slide here, this wonderful caricature cartoon, because it sets up the problem of Hanukkah being one of the group of winter solstice holidays that continues to the present, and the Hanukkah lamp with a focus on the fire because it's the natural thing to do at the end of December. Okay? Now, let's go back. The same Braita in Avodah Zarah has a line which I've highlighted down below. B'shana acheret asa'an le'elu ve'elu yamim tovim. And the next year, our friend Adam HaRishon made this a standard holiday. But look at the nusach, look at the language. B'shana acheret asa'an le'elu le'elu ve'elu le'elu yamim tovim. That will remind you of a line that you may know from the Babylonian Talmud, where we see the standard braita that is preserved in the Babylonian Talmud to answer the same question that Josephus is trying to answer, the same question that the braita in Avodah Zarah is trying to answer. That is my Hanukkah. What is this Hanukkah thing that we're doing? Where they here focus on the lights of the Hanukkah menorah once again, and unlike Adam HaRishon's braita, focus on the very specific internal development of a miracle, the miracle of the oil lasting for 8 days. Now, what I want to focus, however, is the very last line. B'shana acheret kva'um v'asa'um yamim tovim v'halel u'vahoda'ah. In years to come, for the future, they establish this festival of halel, of thanksgiving and thanks. You can see that the Braita in Avodah Zarah and this Braita are cousins. These are two related statements spread across two different parts of the Babylonian Talmud to try to explain it. One, the universal, responding to exactly the kind of impetus that Josephus is responding to, Saturnalia. The other, giving an internal logic for the continuation of fire. This Braita appears in the Babylonian Talmud. We have another version that appears in an Eretz Israeli Midrash called Pasikta Rav Kahana, Pasikta Rabati, excuse me, on the Pasuk Mizmor Shir Chanukata Bayit the David. Yilam Dena Rabbeinu. It's a standard Tanhuma way of opening a shiur in late antiquity. You can imagine somebody getting up in the Beit Midrash or getting up and asking a Chacham in a Beit Knesset, Yilam Dena Rabbeinu, may our teachers teach us. Ner shel Chanukah me matayhi mitzvato, and the lamp of Chanukah, from what point on is it a mitzvah? And it goes on and gives all the standard halachot that I didn't bother quoting because our time is short. And then they ask a great question. They go back to the same question Josephus asked, the same question that Avodah Zarah asked, the same question that Shabbat Kaf Gimel asked. And this is what Pasikta Rabati answers. V'lama madlik nerot b'chanukah? Why do we light lamps on Chanukah? Ella. B'sha'ah shenitzchu banav shel chashmonai kohen hagadol l'malchut yavad. When the sons of Chashmonai defeated the kingdom of Greece, for which he then provides a proof text from Zechariah, and I'm going to skip, nichnasu the Beit HaMikdash, Matzu Sham Shmona Shipudim. They found there eight skewers, right? Skewers, like you use for barbecuing a lamb on Pesach, except out of metal. Shel Barzel, made of iron. Vekavu Otam, and they stuck him in the ground. Vehidliku Betocham Nerot. And they lit within them, meaning within some sort of in the ends, which apparently are concave, so that they could sit there near rope, oil lamps. So in four different places, the fire becomes an important element for dealing with Hanukkah. Hanukkah as the festival of light, Hanukkah as the Jewish winter solstice holiday of note. Now, all of this becomes important in later generations, of course, because how many oil lamps can you have? As Aaron just pointed out, the Rambam points out that you can have an awful lot of oil lamps. Now, what you're looking at, of course, is an oil lamp. It's very similar to the one that I showed you at the beginning. These are from all different periods, some of them facsimiles, all of them in my living room, all of them sitting on a piece of paper towel while I took the picture. Some of them, they created a face on the top, which they're a symbol, the one on the second from the right, a peacock, the one in the middle from Rome, a menorah. And so all these individual lamps that we're still accustomed to light one at a time, or even just one every night on Hanukkah, right into the Middle Ages. And of course, the famous brighter that we just dealt with, Mitzvat Chanukah Ner Ishu Veito V'Mahadrin Ner Lechol Echad V'Echad. Now, I wrote this book called Art and Judaism in the Greco-Roman World, and I pointed out that the term Hidur Mitzvah is relatively late to represent an earlier, rather amorphous concept before the Rishonim came to it and began to specify what Hidur meant. We're dealing with a more general concept, a term that, of course, goes back to the Eitz Pri Hadar and then spread through as a generic term for doing ma'alu me'ever, doing more than you have to. But we're dealing with a mess if you think of all these oil lamps. Ner l'chol echad v'echad. That means one for me, one for you, one for somebody else, right? V'amahadrin, mahadrin. Well, they try something different. Beit Shammai omrim, yom rishon madlik shmona, but Beit Shammai says you light eight, and then you go down to one, and Beit Hillel starts to start with one, and then you go up to eight. And this was a debate that went through antiquity, whether you start with one candle, one lamp, and then build it up the way Beit Hillel would have it, or whether you start with eight lamps and go down to one as Beit Shammai has it. And the debate continued, and I'm quoting from the same Daf of the Gemara, but I'm taking pieces of it. So this debate was strongly contested to the point that the Chachamim in Tveria, you can see Tveria down below on my mat, sent apparently somebody up to a place called Sidon. Now Sidon is, now we now know, a place called El Arash on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was identified pretty conclusively by my friend Steve Notley. You may have read about it in the newspapers lately. It's one of those places Jesus went that had been misidentified and lost. Steve Notley, incidentally, a fellow of our YU Center for Israel Studies. And so they sent a delegation, I would imagine, all the way across the lake. And here we have it. Shneis kenim hayu betzidon. There were two elders in Zidon. So they went up and asked the old people, so why do we do this and how do we do it? Echad asah kebeit Shammai. And one behaved according to the approach of Beit Shammai. Ve'echad asah kedivrei Beit Hillel. So one started with eight and went down to one, and one started with one and went down to eight, went up to eight in the same village. Now, why would you go to a place like that for evidence? Because you're looking for those of the good old days who still keep the old customs, that you want to understand what they were doing. They went off and asked these people, and they didn't ask some old people in Tveria, for example. And they explained what they were doing according to the Gemara, right? One said that the eight relates to the eight to the parim of the chag, to the sacrifice of oxen on Sukkot. That would start with a large number and go down to a small number. Now, for a festival called the rededication of the temple, or dedication in the winter as it is in the New Testament, that makes a certain sense, because we have just as many midrashim that set Chanukah to Mizbeach in Sukkot as we have that set it in Nisan. And in Eretz Yisrael, the Sukkot answer seemed to be the one that was most common. Sukkot as the festival when the Mishkan and then the Beit HaMikdash by Shlomo, and then the return to Babylonia, and then here again when the temple is rededicated. So if the temple is rededicated on Sukkot, then you're going to light lamps, which are now kind of an oxymoron, because we have this notion of dedication on Sukkot along with this dedication of lighting lamps at this winter solstice. So we make our lamps look sort of like, or we behave with our lamps sort of as if it's the approach of Beit Shammai, and we start with a lot of them and go down to one. But Beit Hillel applies a more general principle, which is essential to Beit Hillel, Shema'alim b'kodesh v'leg moridim, that we go up always and never downward. Let's keep going. within centuries, folks were taking lamps that looked like these down below and lighting them, we think. At least such lamps existed in the Greco-Roman period, and Narkes connects them to the story of Hanukkah. The problem, of course, with these lamps is that once you light them, they get really filthy. Now, Masechet Sofrim, which is a sort of tarovah, the mixture of sources that was apparently edited in the early Middle Ages in Italy, deals with this issue. You see down below a copy of an oil lamp that I bought in the old city of Jerusalem that we lit last Hanukkah, and I didn't wash very well. And you can see it's sort of yucky looking and not mechubad, not mehud, not mehader, right? Not what you would expect to use for Hanukkah. Well, get this. Amru be'esrim v'chamisha b'kislev madikin ner Hanukkah. V'asur lahadik ner yashan. And you cannot use an old lamp like the one I have in front of you. V'im lo ein lo ela yashan. But if he only has an old one, malbino ba'ur, he should put it in the fire and clean it off. Yafe yafe v'mutar. Great. Clay lamps have a deficit. You really can't use this lamp more than once. So I don't think Narkes is right. I don't think these lamps were what were being used in antiquity. I think that they caused a definite problem. But at some point, and these are all, the one up above is like 11th century from France, Jews switched to stone. Now, stone lamps in a row are no problem because you can clean them, possibly. The one up above even has an inscription on it, Kiner Mitzvah V'Torah Or, from Mishle, associating the light of Torah and the light of the mitzvah with the Hanukkah menorah, nice choice of psukim. And you see all the lamps in a row on a piece of marble, which is easily cleaned. But down below, you see lamps of similar construction from Bukhara, from North Africa. We have some not here, from Yemen, that's the one to the left. All over the world, Jews were using stone lamps. I can tell you, as one who worked in Judaica at the Israel Museum, they didn't always come out clean. They sometimes were really sort of gooey looking and a problem, especially if they were made out of a stone that was deeply porous. So Jews looked for other solutions as they were living in a society where stone vessels were not the go-to for wealthy people. So up above you see a series of oil lamps that have been set into a base found in Spain from the 15th century, and down below a metal one from illustrated in a 15th century manuscript from Italy. And so they began to create their rows of lamps in ways that did not stay filthy and were, at this point, a single artifact. Now, this single artifact quickly started to be made out of metal. This was from the 13th century from France, with a back. Now, why the back piece? So that it could be hung up opposite the mezuzah on the door. Because if you're going to put your menorah near the door and you can't put it on the outside, especially in places like medieval Ashkenaz, they would put it on the inside of the door. And we begin to hear about such metal objects made with back pieces like this one. For example, the Maharam Rotenberg describes that you should use such objects. And he describes as follows: Kishahiti betzarfat ra'iti et mori Rabbi Shmuel. When I was in France, I saw my teacher Rabbi Shmuel. Shelo hayalo makom acharei hadelet v'hadlik nerot shel Chanukah. He had no place near his door to light his Hanukkah menorah. And so, what did he do? V'hayakoveo tam bedelet atzma. So he would hang them on the door, and you see up above a trefoil, a three-part hanging piece. Let us not remind these people that when Christians put a three-part hanging piece, it referred to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. It was so basic to the culture that no one noticed. But notice also that once you have a back wall, you can begin decorating it. And so the three horseshoe arches down, excuse me, the row of horseshoe arches down below, the two lines separating it from a rose window, typical imagery drawn from church architecture down to the three part structure of the building, the arches down below, the clear story in the middle, the window up above. And of course, while Christians would see the church, Jews would take the greatest buildings of their time and imagine the Beit HaMikdash. Let's try another one. This is my favorite. The one on the left is at Temple Emmanuel. You can go visit it at the museum there. It's the most valuable early Hanukkah menorah, 14th century. Notice the beautiful braided columns in that Gothic way. Above it, the inscription that we saw on the stone objects, which I remind you is down below. Above that, you can see it's been repaired at the very top of the triangle because the hanging place has been used so many times that it broke. And below that, a series of rondelles shaped, the one in the center shaped as tiles. On either side of the rondelles, at the central rondelle, the central circle, lions. And in the center, a dragon. Now, what does that dragon have to do with Hanukkah? Except, of course, a dragon spit fire. I just point that out. I don't know. But the one on the right, which isn't nearly as well made, comes from the collection of, you wouldn't imagine such, Sigmund Freud, that he would collect this Hanukkah menorah makes an awful lot of sense. And it has the same lions, but he has a griffin. Now, what's so cool about this, of course, is that we have this, in the world of the Rishonim, we have the image of a dragon, an image of a griffin, creatures that people in the Middle Ages truly did believe existed somewhere. These were not mythological, but powerful for sure. At the high point of their Hanukkah menorahs, but we shouldn't be so surprised because we look at manuscripts from this period. You find all sorts of crazy looking animals. Look at the base of these two funny looking lions of the Worms Machzor. And also take a look at the images of the buildings above Sha'arei for the Piyut. We have all sorts of Sha'arim. We have the houses of a typical bridge in a medieval city and all those little arches that we've seen on our Hanukkah menorah. So we're dealing with a visual culture shared by Ashkenazim in all sorts of ways. But let me go one more step with this and then we're going to finish. You know, some people may know that I spend a lot of time with the Arch Titus. And on the base of the menorah of the Arch Titus, you can find a lion with a fishtail in the upper left, and you can find a horse with a fishtail in the bottom left. All sorts of mythological creatures that people in antiquity actually believed existed. Now, folks who want to claim that the base of the Arch of Titus menorah isn't real, that it's was added by the Romans because no good from Jew would do such a thing, point to these images and say, you see that? That's clear paganism added. Now, as you can see, Jews also used this imagery into the Middle Ages and didn't think twice about it because these were animals that existed. We hear in a couple of places in Chazal, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Sadok, so said Rabbi Elazar ben Sadok, Kol ha-partzufin hayu b'Yerushalayim chutz me-partzuf ha-adam. You can find any animal face in Jerusalem, but not the face of a human being. And my guess is that whoever donated this particular menorah to the Beit HaMikdash, somehow, when he got the instructions, this is how you're supposed to build a menorah, said, that's pretty. I like the animals. Why not? It's not against the rules I got. And when the Romans took one menorah to Rome as their trophy and left the others behind, this is the one they liked too. Now, I point out that that's another story, the Arch of Titus and its menorah. But what I've tried to do in the last little while is explain how a festival that started as the festival of the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, the rededication, became, in the world of Josephus, the festival of lights. Josephus living in a world where the festival of lights, Saturnalia, was center, how the Seleucids profaned the temple, turning it into a pagan temple, Davka, on the 25th of Kislev, solidifying that date in Jewish culture, and how Josephus's Festival of Lights, with its many lights, went from being the lighting of an oil lamp at the winter solstice by Adam HaRishon to the continuing development of, for me, the most wonderful of all Jewish ritual objects, the one that unites us from Teman to Ashkenaz and even back to the Arch of Titus, the Menorah Shel Chanukah, or if you prefer, the Chanukiah. So with that, let me turn off the slides. Stop. With that, I understand that there are questions, so let's take a look. Stop broadcasting.
1 minute for questions.
Okay, so let me go and see.
Yeah, Alan, just want to identify yourself. Where are you?
I'm here. Sorry.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. Great, we'll take 1 minute for questions. It's okay. It's if anybody has, very, very quickly. All right. Otherwise, we want to thank you because, okay, thank you very much, Professor Fine. Fascinating. And I know we're pressed for time, everybody, but that's it. It's Rizin Makdimi. We're quickly here and a taste of Hanukkah, and then people can come back for more at a later date. Okay.
So thank and everyone, Chag Orim Sameach.
Right. Okay. Chag Orim Sameach. And thank you very much. And okay.